The long legacy of discrimination against Koreans in Japan.
In Japan, it is very difficult to find formal employment if you are Korean, even today. Even today. And for many, many, many decades, legal discrimination against ethnic Koreans was allowed. I think that if you say to somebody, it doesn't matter how hard you try, how hard you study, no matter what, you'll never get a good job, and then they end up in a job that you don't consider good, and then later on you blame them for it, I found that to be morally reprehensible. It's not even ambiguous. It's morally reprehensible to cut people's legs off as they're trying to crawl. And that is something that I did see in Japan and the way it treated the Koreans throughout its history.
That's author Minjin Lee. We talk with her about her acclaimed new novel, Pachinko. It's a multi-generational saga about a Korean family in Japan and how they defy oppression to thrive in a racist society. Then we air an edited version of our 2015 interview with Suki Kim about her book, Without You, There Is No Us. It's her memoir of going undercover in North Korea. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. You can also hear us at PRX. I'm your host, Francesca Rihanna. America has a racism problem, but we aren't the only country where systematic discrimination is practiced against an ethnic minority. In Japan, the despised minority is Korean. I discovered this fact when my son married a Japanese woman of Korean descent. She's in the second generation of her family to be born in Japan. Her grandparents immigrated prior to World War II, when Korea was a Japanese colony. Yet she's not considered a Japanese citizen. She carries a Korean passport, although she's never been to Korea and speaks not one word of the language. And on her passport is the Korean name the government gave her, not the Japanese name she was given at birth and grew up with. My daughter-in-law feels deep ambivalence about Japan. She feels completely Japanese, but is also outraged at the way her society has treated her and her family. My guest Minjin Lee's terrific new novel, Pachinko, tells the story of another Korean family in Japan that is not very different from that of my daughter-in-law. Spanning three generations of Koreans in Japan from the early years of the 20th century to 1989, Pachinko shows how Koreans responded to the restricted lives the Japanese imposed on them with ingenuity and resilience. Much like Jews in medieval Europe, who went into the despised business of banking because they weren't allowed to work in almost any other area, Koreans in Japan took over the pachinko gambling industry as one of the few arenas where they could find employment. Pachinko is a national bestseller, a compulsive read that tells a powerful story about a history unknown to most Americans. And it's not just history, author Minjin Lee says. Despite some gains, Japan, like the U.S., is still steeped in ethnic prejudice. Minjin Lee's first novel was Free Food for Millionaires. Pachinko is her second. A national bestseller, it's a New York Times editor's choice and among the top 10 novels of the year for the Times of London and USA Today. Well, Minjin Lee, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you for having me, Francesca.
Well, first I want to say that Pachinko was one of the most compelling reads that I've had in a long time, and I read a lot of great books, but this one, which is a long one, I had to force myself to put down. It was really a terrific book, and also a book that was personally important to me because I actually have my daughter-in-law was born in Japan from a Korean family, and this is very much a subject of this book. It follows one Korean family from the early 1900s all the way up to 1989, four generations from Korea to Japan. And at the center of the story is really the pervasive discrimination against Koreans by the Japanese. And the book starts out with a very striking line, "History has failed us, but no matter." And I wonder if you could just start out by saying, why did you begin the book with that sentence?
You know, it's interesting. It's a sentence that sort of came to me fully formed. I have to say that writing for me is really difficult, but that sentence was just kind of a nice gift. And it really sort of emblematizes my entire feeling about the way Koreans have been treated around the world, which is that I think that they are people who have been betrayed by history so many times and so often. And they are often not at the tables in which great decisions about their nation were made. And consequently, when I think of history, I do think of it almost like a person. I give it a kind of an anthropomorphic sense. And I personalize it because it's a force, it's a living force, and very often regular people don't get to participate in it, and certainly they're not documented.
Yeah, I think one reviewer said that history is actually a character in this novel, which I thought was a nice way of putting it.
Well, thank you. And I guess I have to agree that history is always part of every single novel, whether it's a historical novel or not, because if it's a real book at all, it has a context of what's going on today. And whether or not you write about it, it's still part of the atmosphere. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but this one is the history is right up, right front and center. Give us an overview of the history covered by the novel from the perspective of the relationship between Japan and Korea.
I think that it is impossible to understand the history of Korea without understanding its intersection of its history with Korea and Japan, because Japan annexed Korea as its kind of breadbasket in its reach to become a global empire. And in order for Japan to become a global empire, it needed to acquire different resources and lands in order to strengthen itself, because Japan is a country that has many things, but it does not have many natural resources except water. It doesn't have a lot of agrable land, so Korea became a kind of breadbasket for Japan. In the process of taking over an entire country, many, many things happened to the Korean people themselves, and one of the things is that they became impoverished through land surveys and taxes, which the Japanese, the colonial power, did. And there became many economic migrants who moved to Korea, and then later on during World War II, many Koreans were actually became forced laborers in its attempt to become even a bigger empire, and because Japan essentially ran out of men. So Korean men became part of the forced laborers. But I start my book in 1910, and then the journey that my main character, Sanja, takes is actually in the 1930s. And she goes there not because as an economic migrant, and she does not go as a forced laborer. She goes because she gets pregnant, and then she marries another man who is not the father of her child. And then she goes to Japan not knowing if she will be there forever, but she does end up staying there forever.
Right, Sunja. My daughter-in-law's name that she was given is Sunji.
Wow.
But that's not the name that she grew up with. She grew up with a Japanese name, and was only when she emigrated to the United States, she was given a Korean passport and a Korean name. So I wonder if you could explain that phenomenon, and before we even go further into the story of the book, which I want to do, explain that kind of discrimination that made that happen.
It's really fascinating, because when the Koreans became a colonial subject of Japan, they actually had citizenship. But then after the war, they were stripped of their citizenship, and they were pretty much asked to leave. So kind of like, you're here, we thought you were great when we needed you, but now you have to go back. And of course, they couldn't go back because Korea is an incredibly poor country and things were going very poorly there in terms of its influx of communism. And the nation was kind of preparing for war. There was a lot of political infighting. And so what ended up happening is when the Koreans lost their Japanese citizenship, they had to make choices. And there are immigration laws which happen almost every few years, so I won't bore you with all the details. But essentially today in 2017, there are three paths that a person of Korean descent can be in Japan, and no matter how many generations they've been there. You can have a South Korean passport, which is probably what your daughter-in-law has. And a South Korean passport really came out as a result of a 1965 normalization treaty between South Korea and Japan, because South Korea and Japan have a diplomatic relationship, that those people who decided to ally themselves with the government of South Korea, who are of Korean descent, have a South Korean passport. And it's amazing because some of these people have never been to South Korea, but they were born in Japan. Their parents are born in Japan. The other alternative is to become a naturalized Japanese citizen, which is not easy to do, and in many ways politically complicated emotionally, because you might not want to be the Japanese citizen after having endured so many things. So they are permanent residents, so they can't be kicked out per se today, but they are allied, some of them, with the North Korean government. And that's another tricky complication because North Korea and Japan do not have a diplomatic relationship, which means you have a kind of a card, but you don't have a passport, and it allows it, you are not allowed to travel. So now we've talked about three different choices. You have, you could become a Japanese citizen, not easy to do, because you have to go through many different steps, and you have to have a lot of different people who are from Japan vouching for you, and that's not easy to do. Secondly, you can have a South Korean passport, which is kind of the majority experience at this moment of people of ethnic Korean backgrounds. And then you can also have a North Korean affiliation, which means, and that organization is called the Soren, S-O-R-E-N. So your daughter-in-law probably has an affiliation with the Mindan, which is a South Korean government one, M-I-N-D-A-N. And those are the three things that you can be today at 2017, and you can be four or five generations from Japan.
Exactly. I mean, she's a third generation in Japan and does not speak Korean, has never been to Korea.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I wrote specifically about her community and people who are even older than in her family ancestry.
Yeah. And so let's go back to the story. Sunja, who is the first protagonist in this story, I mean, there are the action passes from her as time goes on. She, as you said, she gets pregnant. She gets pregnant with a mobster who is also a Korean who lives in Japan, but has been able to kind of, to make it. I mean, in fact, he's one of the wealthiest people in, well, certainly in his circles. I mean, quite a wealthy man. Talk about the path that he took to his position and why that might have been one of the few paths open to him.
Well, Hunsu, the man that you speak of, who is the father of Sunja's first child, Noah, is absolutely a criminal. He is an organized criminal, and he is a gangster, and he is called what is famously known as the Yakuza. And they are people who are known in Japan, not historically as always being Korean. They're actually, many of them are ethnically Japanese, and the Yakuza is comprised of a Japanese, ethnic Korean, ethnic Chinese, and also Brahmin. And it's kind of a huge tent of people of different ethnicities. And the reason why I mention this is because in Japan, it is very difficult to find formal employment if you are Korean, even today. Even today. And for many, many, many decades, legal discrimination against ethnic Koreans was allowed. So today, it may not necessarily be allowed formally for somebody to like, if you were, let's say, a Japanese citizen and you are of ethnic Korean background, you probably can have a stand and sue if you weren't hired for a corporate position. But it's incredibly difficult to prove and very expensive. However, if you are a South Korean citizen like your daughter-in-law and she wanted to apply for certain positions depending upon the locality, she can today be legally discriminated against because she is seen as a foreigner, even though she is third generation culturally Japanese.
Wow. So how does this come about? I mean, is this just endemic in something in Japanese culture, or is this really a product of the imperialist culture?
You know, it's kind of funny, but as a former attorney, I have to say that one of the things that we have to recognize around the world is that the United States and the UK and certain other governments allow people to have citizenship just by being born there. However, this practice is not universal. So Japan's situation with the Koreans is not so completely anomalous to how the world sees immigration laws. That said, what is ironic about the Japanese treatment of the Koreans is that many of them came as a direct result of the colonization of the country. either through economic migration or through forced laborers, and they helped to build Japan to become a great nation. So consequently, they may have permanent resident status, but they do not have the full rights and liberties of those who deserve to have citizenship and its freedoms, including things like social benefits.
Oh, really? They don't have the same, let's say, pension rights that others have?
No.
Wow.
No.
So now tell us about Sunja. She moves to Japan during the imperialist era because she's pregnant. Her mobster boyfriend is married, so there's no help for her there. What happens to her?
Well, she cannot marry Hansu because he's married to a Japanese mobster's daughter. So he obviously cannot marry her. He wants to take care of her, but she's not interested in that kind of relationship. She is a boarding house keeper's daughter, and her mother and she nurse a visiting pastor to health, and he offers to marry her, and he offers to marry her and take her to Osaka, where he intends to become a kind of missionary to the Korean-Japanese population, and she goes with him. She is not a Christian in the beginning of the book, and she goes there, and she becomes part of his family. And then she grows up in this neighborhood called Ikaino, which is currently called Ikuno today, but back then it was called Ikaino. And that's the Korean ghetto of Osaka because all ethnic Koreans were essentially forced to live there because they could not find housing anywhere else. And these shanty towns are literally shanty towns, like corrugated metal, found materials, no glass for windows, no running water. It was just deplorable living conditions. And that's where all the Koreans lived, despite how much money you had or your background.
Now, during the war, her husband is imprisoned and goes through a terrible experience. Was this common at that
yes.
time?
Yes. Most Western missionaries left Japan during the war because in Japan, the national religion is Shintoism, in which the emperor is a god. So if the emperor is a god, that means that if you believe in somebody else being a god, you're essentially being idolatrous against Shintoism. And during the war, with great nationalism, especially when Japan was trying to build as an immense Eastern power to rival that of the West, they promoted Shintoism and all the nationalist practices, which meant that during the week, on a daily basis, on a daily practice or on a weekly practice, if you and I lived in Japan as members of a community, we'd have to go to the local shrine and bow in front of the temple gods. And that would be a demonstration of your being a national loyalty. So if you did not do that, and if you felt that that violated what you believe in, that would cause you very serious problems.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Min Jin Lee about her latest book, Pachinko. It's on the national bestseller list, and it is absolutely terrific. Now, Min Jin Lee, you lived in Japan for several years. Were you doing the historical research for this book at that time?
Yes, actually. I actually started this book in 1996. I got the idea for the book in 1989 when I was in college. But I really started writing it in 1996, and I had an entire manuscript done before I moved to Japan. It's the manuscript that I finished before my published novel, Free Food for Millionaires, which was my debut. And then the reason why I never pursued publication with the original manuscript of Pachinko is because it was academically accurate, but it didn't really feel like literature. So in 2007, when I moved to Japan, I got a chance to interview dozens upon dozens of Korean Japanese, and in that experience, and also got to visit places like Ikuno and all the other outlying areas where Koreans lived, and got to interview pachinko parlor owners, I realized that the reason why that first manuscript didn't work as literature is because it was essentially a history book, whereas I think Pachinko is really written as a novel where you have one family being present rather than just a kind of victim's right manifesto, which is kind of like what I wrote the first time, because now I don't see the Korean Japanese as victims, even though they were discriminated against and they are discriminated against. When you meet them, you realize how silly it is to just see them as people who are oppressed, because they don't see themselves that way. They see that as part of life and that suffering is something that must be endured and overcome, and their resilience and their joyfulness just really amazed me. So I had to rewrite the entire book.
Yes, and it seemed to me, you know, Pachinko, the title of the book, the subject of it doesn't really come on until at least halfway through.
Mm-hmm.
And as that developed, I began to think that Pachinko was in some ways a metaphor, not just a subject, a metaphor for exactly this kind of joyfulness and resilience that you just mentioned.
Yeah, a Pachinko, as you may know, is a $203 billion industry. Which is a catastrophically, incredibly gargantuan sum of like money that can kind of make and destroy economies. $203 billion. That's more than twice the export revenues of the Japanese car industry. One out of 11 people in Japan play pachinko regularly. That's how important it is as an industry in this nation. And it's only really played in Japan, nowhere else. Having said that, it is dominated very much by the Korean-Japanese community that make the machines, run the machines themselves, run businesses, and sometimes own the whole parlors. That said, there are other people who are involved in pachinko, not just the Koreans. However, it's perceived as primarily a Korean-Japanese business now. And I really intended it to be an allegory of the way life is for not just the Korean Japanese, but really for all of us, because pachinko is gambling. So it's no different than like when you go to Las Vegas, the house always wins. You may win, but the house always wins in terms of its statistics. And I think that one of the things that I feel at my age, and I'm 48, is that I think in many ways we often know when things are rigged and things aren't fair. But nevertheless, we have to play. There's really no choice about it. And I guess for me, pachinko was a kind of allegory for the Korean Japanese, but it's also an allegory for all of us because we know that things are unfair and yet we still have to play.
Oh, that is so eloquent. And yes, of course, I agree with that.
Thank you.
And also it is the business that enables Koreans to thrive. They were able to go. I mean, in some ways, it reminds me of the history of Jews in Europe who, you know, thrived in peddling and in banking because that's the only place they could actually get work. And this is very much the same kind of a situation here for Koreans in Japan. But they do so well with it that, you know, it, like you say, they become real leaders in that.
Yeah, there is a direct parallel to the way Jews have been treated around the world and the way the Koreans have been treated in Japan. And I raise this point in the chapter about Daniel Deronda because George Eliot, in her incredible wisdom, saw the persecution of Jews in England, and she wrote about Zionism. And yet I also try very hard to talk about it because if you look at 19th century literature, and that's the foundation of my education as a writer, the Jews were never allowed to be white. So even if they tried to be white, they were never considered part of the majority. They were always considered other, and they're either given extraordinary skills or qualities or given incredibly negative qualities, but they're never allowed to be normal. And I always thought that was very interesting to me, and certainly a lot of very important Jewish literary scholars have written about this. Whether, like, the woman who, there are women in Balzac's books where if they're Jewish women, they're usually very good singers, they're incredibly beautiful, and men lose their lives in order to, like, support them and, you know, trick them out in their finery. And then you also have Jewish male characters who are very good in business and, let's say, at the House of Mirth, like by Edith Wharton. And I was interested in how do we perceive the person who essentially looks like you, but we must make him or her the other. And in Japan, it's almost impossible to tell the difference between a Korean and Japanese person, especially a person who's incredibly assimilated. And yet, it's constantly brought up as somebody different because of their blood. And that discussion of blood, I think, makes all of us very uncomfortable.
Yes, and seems to be coming back into vogue in these days in the United States. I mean, in some ways, there are certainly parallels here, maybe not to Jews in the United States, but to African Americans.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the Jews are being persecuted right now. I mean, recently when those gravestones were toppled over and temples have been threatened, and I think African Americans have been threatened since the moment they arrived in this country, and they continue to be threatened. You know, apparently Steve Bannon's image of the presidency that Donald Trump wants to have is one of Andrew Jackson, somebody who truly wanted to restore slavery. Like, it's absolutely unrecognizable to me to see this reversal in the advancement of civil rights in this country. It's shocking.
Yes.
It's shocking.
Yeah. Now, back to the book, Pachinko, Sunja has two sons, one of whom is the son of this Japanese mobster. The younger one, Masasu, is the one who at first is the first one to go into the pachinko business. What's the relationship between her two children?
They have different fathers. They do not know about this, and it's fine. They are both men who are trying to understand how to be men as oppressed minorities. And one of the things that I was really interested in exploring was a notion of masculinity for men who are part of an oppressed class. So I think men universally, cross-culturally, wish to be good providers. But however, if you are prohibited from getting even normal lower middle class or middle class jobs or have consistent employment, then it's going to be a very difficult dynamic between you as a man and the women in your lives, because you cannot provide for them, you cannot take care of them, you cannot protect them. And so in the trajectories of all the male characters in my book, but especially between Moses and Noah, the two brothers, you have two different approaches. Noah wishes to be considered an excellent Korean living in Japan. And the way he does that is by trying to be a very good student, by knowing everything well, trying to do everything well, like whether it's running for his school team or getting the highest marks in the class. And then he pursues an education at a very excellent university called Waseda. And then Moses, on the other hand, has no intentions of trying to be an excellent Korean living in Japan because he thinks it's pointless. And he becomes more adaptive in terms of business. He also has a lot more rage than his brother does, and in his rage, he has lots more fights. And that fighting leads him to business, and as he gets older, obviously, he fights less. And he goes into pachinko, and he becomes a very successful business person. And I wanted to give that sort of contrast. And then what's interesting about Noah, and I'm not giving much away, is that he does end up in pachinko, because what ends up happening for men who are in oppressed minorities, who are oppressed minorities, is that no matter how hard they try, sometimes the institutions won't allow you to make your own choices.
And then there's another aspect to the pachinko part of the story, and that is that it has a kind of moral ambiguity of its own. I mean, it is gambling.
Mm-hmm.
The house always wins, as you say. I mean, there's an exploitative aspect to it, and yet it is the only vehicle for success for the characters in the book. So talk about how you worked with that delicate line of moral ambiguity there.
I found the hypocrisy of a nation and a social norm that tolerates and encourages an incredibly lucrative business, and yet having social contempt for it, really something that needed to be exposed. I think that if you say to somebody, it doesn't matter how hard you try, how hard you study, no matter what, you'll never get a good job, and then they end up in a job that you don't consider good, and then later on you blame them for it, I found that to be morally reprehensible. It's not even ambiguous. It's morally reprehensible to cut people's legs off as they're trying to crawl. And that is something that I did see in Japan in the way it treated the Koreans throughout its history. And I don't think it's unique to Japan. I think many, many countries are very cruel to its outsiders. But I think after a while, those outsiders can't always be outsiders. It seems to be almost counterintuitive for a nation to feel this way about one group of people. The Chinese are now bigger ethnically as a minority in Japan than Koreans, and that's a recent phenomenon, but not by a huge amount. Right now, the number of ethnic Koreans in Japan is about 600,000. At its very height, it was almost 2 million during the war efforts.
What's happened to that population?
Oh, well, after the war, over a million returned, and some of them returned to North Korea, which is not where they're actually from. Most people who are ethnic Koreans in Japan are actually from the southern regions, as well as the island of Jeju, which is where Hunsu, one of my main characters, comes from. But they go back to North Korea because after the war, Japan decided that they wanted to make sure that they didn't have to socially support the poor Koreans in Japan, and they encouraged them to repatriate to North Korea. And North Korea, of course, wanted these people because many of them had materials and resources, and they were given false promises of perfect treatment. And this is all covered in a beautiful book called Exodus to North Korea by Tessa Morris Suzuki, who's a very good historian.
And yet when they went back to Korea, so many of them, I gather from your book, Pachinko mentioned, Lee, from the novel, that when they went back to Korea, they weren't accepted there either.
No, and they're still not accepted today. So when they went to the North, they weren't accepted because they were perceived as kind of traitors for having been almost culturally Japanese, and they are culturally Japanese. Like, if I went somewhere, I am culturally American. You know, I go by Min or Minjin, and I don't do many of the things that I think a traditional person from South Korea may have done or may do today in terms of mannerisms, especially as a female. And I would be surprised if they didn't consider me American. However, so when a person is culturally Japanese, goes somewhere and goes to North Korea and they're treated as Japanese, it's incredibly hurtful because they weren't feeling like they were at home in Japan either. Even today, when a person of ethnic Korean background from Japan goes to South Korea, very often he or she may be criticized for being Japanese. And that's, again, incredibly unfair and harmful. And this is something that I saw in every one of my interviews who are people of ethnic Korean descent who are culturally Japanese.
Now, finally, you were born in Korea. You grew up in Queens.
Uh-huh.
As you just said, you're culturally American. You've lived in Japan. You've been steeped in this history. What has been your experience in going through this, both personally and professionally? What have been the lessons or the things that have been most important to you in the process of doing this?
That's a really good question. I think that for me, what's been really most gratifying is to learn that the people with whom I share some cultural and historical lineage, and I can't say that we're all the same because we're all so different, I think what I really learned is the level of resilience and the adaptiveness of Koreans, that despite whatever extraordinary circumstance, that they were willing, for the most part, able to handle it and take on these indignities with great elegance and humility and humor. I saw a lot of humor when I was interviewing people, and that was really kind of fun, too. And they had a kind of wishfulness that did not die, even though the world around them said that it should not belong. And I found that to be really inspiring.
Well, that's beautiful. Minjin Lee, your terrific novel is Pachinko, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you so much, Francesca, for having me.
Read an excerpt from Pachinko at writersvoice.net. Next up, we hear an edited version of my 2015 interview with Suki Kim about her book, Without You, There Is No Us, Undercover Among the Sons of the North Korean Elite. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Korea North and South has been much in the news recently, and we're talking about Koreans today. In our first segment, we talked about Koreans in Japan, as we spoke with Minjin Lee about her novel Pachinko. But North Korea has been much in the news lately, as the Trump administration seems to be taking a hard line against the bellicose leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un. Suki Kim taught in Korea for the year before the death of Kim's father, Kim Jong-il. I spoke with her about her memoir of that time, Without You, There Is No Us, back in 2015. Let's hear an edited version of that conversation. The Korean War of 1950 to 1953 is a wound that has marked nearly every Korean family with tragedy and loss. South Korean-born writer Suki Kim's family is no exception. Her 17-year-old uncle disappeared at the beginning of the war, probably taken captive by North Korea. That country is a pariah among nations. Its people are sealed behind impenetrable walls of tyranny and censorship. When we think of the North Korean people, we picture them as a faceless mass, starving from famine or mindlessly hailing their great leader in brainwashed unison. Suki Kim wants to change that notion. She wants us to see the people inside the faceless mass. Kim went to North Korea to find out for herself what life is like for the North Koreans, even though she knew she could only have access to a tiny slice of that society. She went undercover and got a job teaching English to the sons of the North Korean elite. Her every move was watched, not just by her North Korean minders, but also by her evangelical Christian colleagues who ran the school where she taught. But despite the strict controls, Suki Kim was able to make a profound human connection to her students, young men who, after all, were not so different from teenage boys anywhere. Her wonderful book, Without You, There Is No Us, humanizes them and, in the process, invites her readers to deepen our own humanity. Suki Kim, welcome to Writer's Voice. You went to teach in a school run by evangelical Christians in North Korea in 2011. Tell us about the school. It's the Pyongyang University of Science and Technology. How did this begin, and how did it get permission to actually exist?
It's a school only for young men. And at the time, there were about 270 students. Now there are more, and they're selected sons of the elite. The school was allowed to exist because the organization that founded the school had been courting North Korea for a long time. And they basically made an unofficial deal with the North Korean government that they would fund the school entirely, which cost over $35 million to build, and continue to fund it, operate it, supply teachers. Basically, North Korea does not have to pay a penny. And the condition they gave was do not proselytize. I mean, they were perfectly aware these are evangelical Christians, but they told them not to proselytize and come in and basically set up this whole venture for free. And, it's a logical step for North Korea because the school is such a nice-looking school with a nice-looking student. So it creates a perfect propaganda for North Korea to present to the world that that's what schools are like in North Korea, which is not the case.
When you started working there, these were the only students who were actually going to school at the time. How was that?
Well, I found that, I didn't know going in, although I heard whispers about it, that year when I was there, it was 2011, ended up being the final year of Kim Jong-il's life. It also was 2011 was Juche 100. Juche means self-reliance, which is the great leader's philosophy. And 100, meaning the 100th year since the original great leader's birth. He died in 1994, but they were still celebrating his birthday. And so that year was a very important year. And in order to celebrate Juche 100, they put all the university students, they shut down every university around the country, put all of them in construction fields in order to build a powerful and prosperous nation, which is a North Korean slogan for their nation always. But it turned out only these 270 students at Pyongyang University of Science and Technology were allowed to be in school. It's sort of a little bit like hiding out in this suburb of Pyongyang, learning English. And, you know, when I realized that they were basically creme de la creme, they were the only ones not sent to construction field, which suggested to me that we're the future leaders of North Korea. And also the fact, this is 2011, there was Arab Spring around the world. It was very particular time. So it seemed the regime's effort to sort of spread the students around the country and make sure they don't congregate in a university and just keep them busy. So, and my students were hiding out a political storm, it seemed. And sure enough, by the end of that year, it seemed that they knew that regime change was coming. And by the end of that year, Kim Jong-il died.
So tell us about your students. You actually became very fond of them. In fact, you grew to love them.
I absolutely loved all of them. First of all, we were not allowed to leave the campus. The boys were never allowed to leave. The teachers were only, we only left on minder-guided group outings. So basically, we were locked in there. It was guarded by the military. And it was just, I had to do everything with them, eat with them three times a day, and play sports with them, and teach them all day, and give office hours. Because we spent so much time together, I think I began to, in a way, understand them. You know, that it's not their fault that they're sons of the elite. In some, many, many ways, they were a lot like just normal 19-year-olds. You know, these boys who, you know, giggle at the mention of girls or, you know, make, you know, silly jokes and just adorable. And also because North Koreans are so sheltered from the outside world, they were so innocent. They didn't know at all what was going on outside. And it also made them far more childlike. And I think I also empathize. There was a lot of stuff about them, things about them that I found very disturbing, like they lied constantly. But I think after being there a while, I realized that the system they were in was this incredibly inhumane system that really forced them to lie in many cases. And yet they were just like, you know, you and me in some way. And I think that predicament they were in, I began to empathize with it more and more, which probably made me love them more.
What do you mean by they lie? Could you give us some examples?
There were very different tiers of lies. You know, they lied to just cover up things. You know, they would tell me, you know, like they did so many great leader duties. For example, they would have to guard this empty building that was building of great leader studies, where they would disappear every day to study the great leader. It's called Kim Il-sung-ism, just study of the great leader. So, but they would never, they would, you know, kind of pretend they didn't do it if I asked them. So there were things like that. And so many other, you know, they had to watch the bottom of the great leader tower, which is covered with designs of the great leader flowers, for example. They would have to watch that every day. But they would tell me they didn't. So there were these kind of lies where it was to protect their system. But then there were sometimes who lie, you know, for no reason whatsoever. Like, you know, they wouldn't have done their homework. But if I ask them, where is it? They'll say it's in their bag. And then when I say, can you please take it out, please? They'll say, oh, it's in my notebook. And then, you know, it's like a children lie in a way. And I realized those were just like random lies, as if because there were so many lies in their system. And for example, they told me that they cloned the rabbit when they were fifth graders. And that was kind of a nonsense to me. And I couldn't really understand where these lies were coming from. So basically, to protect their system, also, they were told so many lies. And also because sometimes it felt like lies were not necessarily a bad thing in their system.
What do you mean, not a bad thing?
Like one time we played this, like a game in an activity hour we had. And, you know, some students said, oh, I wish we had cheated better because, you know, we cheated, but we should have cheated better. So we should have won. And that, I guess, is telling truth. But I realized to say that aloud was somehow not a bad thing. Or they told me basically hackers are rewarded if they hack really well by their system. So, you know, although hacking, basically, they get taught hacking in college, I was told, that it's not a bad thing somehow. So, I mean, they're 20-year-olds. For them to not realize that, I realized there were just sort of a different standard there.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Suki Kim about her book, without you, there is no us, my time with the Sons of North Korea's elite. One of the things that I loved about your book was the way you went into the contradictions and the ambiguities of your relationship with them. As you say, they lied, makes it hard to have a relationship of trust. On the other hand, you really did grow to love them. You had a lot of do's and don'ts as a result of being a teacher there, things that you could do that you couldn't do, things you were told in the beginning, but also that you learned along the way. Could you tell us a little bit about the restrictions under which you operated?
To begin with, we were given a set of do's and don'ts, and that was an extensive list of things to not talk about, such as don't ever suggest there's something wrong with our country, or don't ever point at the portrait of, you know, Kim Jong-il, Kim Il-sung, those great leader portraits. Don't even, you know, point to them with your finger because that would be considered disrespectful. Or don't wear jeans because Kim Jong-il doesn't like jeans. Don't compare and don't say, you know, they do this back home, but they don't do it here. Things like that because it could be considered a put down. Don't ever discuss politics. If anybody ever says anything political, just say, is that so? And walk away, for example. So there were many, many, many things that you were not allowed to do. And also I was told when I started teaching there that there was a group of North Korean staff called counterparts, and they had to look at all our lesson plans beforehand and approve it, like every lesson. So I knew that it was, you know, basically the each class, not only do I get a permission beforehand, but I was also told in the class some students are reporting on it and recording it. And also, because I ate meals with them, every meal is three students and me in the cafeteria for every meal. And I knew that they were also reporting on those conversations we had. So I think that this just, it was just hyper vigilance that makes it very, very hard to be, first of all, you're never on your own because you're always watched all the time, even in your room because your rooms are bugged. So, you know, I think that that just makes you constantly watching yourself. But also, I think that does affect the relationship with the students whom I really began to love. But, you know, sometimes it was hard to trust which one was going to report on me, you know, for something randomly I might have said at the lunch table. And because also they were watching each other, you know, because then I would be afraid that I would maybe one student might get in trouble by me saying something or some discussion that was brought up at the table. So I think at times, I think I have this in the book, I felt like a mother afraid of her own children.
And you faced a kind of contradiction yourself because you actually wanted to open them up to the world. You wanted to transgress these boundaries that you had to operate within, but do it in a kind of way where almost nobody would notice, as you say. Could you talk about that? How did you deal with this desire to show them that there was a different world, a wider world there, without getting anybody in trouble?
Yeah, I mean, that was a constant, I think, dilemma I faced there. And obviously, my evangelical Christian colleagues were, you know, for example, trying to turn them onto Jesus in a subtle way, but, you know, do it in a way nobody notices. I mean, that seemed to be a theme of everything being underhanded is a theme of being, you know, experience of what it's like to be in North Korea. But, you know, as a person who has all this information coming from outside to be there and not allowed to talk about any of it, you know, the students didn't even know what the internet was. Or, you know, they thought nobody moved around because none of them were allowed to go anywhere, even within their own country. They hadn't seen anything. They thought people ate kimchi outside in the rest of the world and, you know, that they envied the Korean language. So all this basically a lot of nonsense they get taught. And, you know, your instinct is to somehow suggest that there is a world outside where actually there is freedom. But I realized if I were to show that to them, then that student might get in trouble or, you know, be unhappy forever also because they're stuck there. And I think, you know, it's easier to look at it and think I want to go and like tell them about freedom, you know, when we're sitting here in New York. But when you're in that situation where such a knowledge could mean death, you know, it was very soul-searching because I would sometimes, you know, give a little hint of that there's more outside. But then you know, I would worry right away because I think, what am I doing? Because, you know, I love them. These are like my kids, and I don't want them to be the one who sacrificed their lives in order to bring freedom to this country, for example. I just wanted them to be safe. So I think I didn't care about much else. And I think that created a huge conflict in my mind constantly. Then I thought, what am I doing here?
Say a little bit more about that. What am I doing here? I mean, this must have been incredible pressure on you.
I knew that I was writing a book. So that is how I would tell, you know, I knew that ultimately, you know, I wrote every night, every morning, you know, whatever time I could find myself, and took all these notes. And that was supposed to come up with a real inside portrait of North Korea, that in a humanizing portrait. I knew that's what I was there for. But because I was forming such a close bond with these students, my instinct to want to tell them, for example, I call them gentlemen all the time. And I don't know why I did that. You know, I think that in Korea, sometimes my dad would use the word gentleman, the English word gentleman, to suggest very dashing modern men. So I think that's where it came from. But part of me did want them to be gentle. So I thought, you know, if I call them gentlemen enough times, then they will, you know, really be gentle in life and will lead a very gentle life, which is opposite what we, you know, think of North Korea as. And then one student, I assigned them these weekly letters to me. I said, just, you know, it's practice in English, and I got it approved by the North Korean staff. And one student wrote, you know, teacher, you call us gentlemen, which, you know, they loved it. They would always giggle when I call them gentlemen. And they say, he said, but I know why you call us gentlemen, because you want us to be gentle in life. And it was amazing to me. He understood my intention. But then when he said that, you know, there was also a sinking in my heart, because I thought, is that a good thing to do, to be gentle under Kim Jong-un regime? Because I don't think it's that safe to be gentle under Kim Jong-un regime for my students' survival. There were many, many moments like these where I wasn't sure what I was doing was helping them or harming them.
It's almost like you were being forced to lie as well.
Well, I mean, there was part of my position there was really being an undercover journalist, which, you know, undercover journalism is necessary in order to investigate a subject that will not be investigated in any open way. However, you know, it is a position where when you are forming personal relationships, it's always on your mind because you're not telling the full truth in a way. But there was no way I could have told them that. Also, when you're embedded, you know, it's not like I was interviewing people, right? Which is what journalists do. They sit down and they tell them, I'm going to write about you and do an interview and write that down and then write a book. That is not how North Korea could possibly be written about, because they will never tell you that, because it's a country of lies and propaganda. So if you do that, then you're coming out with basically a North Korean government-sponsored propaganda. You're being their publicist and being promoting their agenda, which I had no interest of doing. But because when you are embedded, however, and you're not telling them you're going to write a book about them, you know, it's a constantly in a position where you constantly have to question yourself.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Suki Kim about her book, Without You, There Is No Us, My Time with the Sons of North Korea's Elite. I'd like to go to your own background, because this is, of course, a very important part of the story. You grew up in South Korea until the age of 13, and then you came to this country. Could you talk a little bit about how the impact of your life as a South Korean, what impact that had when now you went to North Korea? How was that for you, even just emotionally?
Well, I was born and raised in South Korea. I came to the United States when I was 13. I was born into families on either side of my family that were separated during the war. There were members of family that were lost to North Korea during the war. For example, my mother's brother, who was 17, and, you know, he was taken away by the North Korean. We are from the South. So from Seoul, when the North Korean bombs started coming, you know, that was at the start of the Korean War, he was taken by the North Korean soldiers and were never seen again. So, you know, that sorrow that my grandmother, I mean, she basically died of a heartbreak to lose her oldest child and basically never saw him again. And it's also, I think separation is different from dying. You know, knowing Seoul is just a few hours from Pyongyang. And, you know, she heard from people who saw him being taken away that they were taking him to Pyongyang. But then the border came down and she could never go there. And I think people don't realize how this Korean division that basically affected millions of families. You know, this wasn't just my family. This is millions of families who never saw their child again or their husband or their mother. I mean, you know, we have so many of these families who basically spent their lives because Korean War was not a war that was a civil war as it was portrayed. You know, Korean War was a Cold War that the history of Korea is it's a kingdom, 5,000-year-old kingdom, and it was colonized by Japan. And the Allies came to liberate it from Japan. At the end of World War II, it was the United States that cut up Korea. The 38th parallel was actually drawn by the United States. It had nothing to do with the conflicts between Korean people. There had never been a tribal fight or anything of such. So basically, my grandmother's generation did not understand why this border came down, and they kind of assumed that it was going to open up. So I think my grandmother spent her life thinking, you know, what is this border that suddenly I can't go to the other side? It's like Brooklyn to New York, and suddenly, you know, you can't cross Brooklyn Bridge and get to Brooklyn, and then 60 years pass. So my grandmother basically waited for this border to lift so she can, you know, see her son again. So I think that sorrow was so heavily embedded in the South Korean, Korean culture. So I grew up with that sorrow. So I think, but then, you know, I ended up coming to America at 13. I lost my home, although it was my parents' decision to immigrate. It was not my decision. I was a child. So I lost home. I lost my language. I wanted to be a writer, always, even as a little girl. And suddenly, I didn't speak a word of English. And I was Asian, you know, like my identity. I didn't know I was Asian. You don't know you're Asian if you're, you know, living in Asia. So this race thing was something I never knew. So I think it was just everything came, basically my ground that I stood on, you know, was just gone one day. And I think basically later on, I think when I went to North Korea, the complicated history of my family and the separation and my own, I think, sensitivity to separation and losing home all kind of came together where I think I really, really identified with the sorrow. And on top of all that, I think my grandmother's generation, Korean War was, you know, over 60 years ago, and that generation died. And I think as a writer, also, the real claustrophobia of an untold story, you know, the sorrow that affected millions of people, and you would think somebody would have actually, you know, told this story, but there, you know, it wasn't ever, it was basically a sorrow that was not requited ever, you know, never found a closure. None of those people got to see their loved ones again. And I think that horrific missing somebody for the rest of your life for millions of people, I think I wanted to write about that.
And you did so powerfully. Suki Kim. I spoke with her in 2015. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the entire interview and to read a chapter from Without You, There Is No Us. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.